That was Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting a powerful suicide blast in a hospital complex in the southwest Pakistani city of Quetta Mundi killed at least 70 people and wounded more than 100. The blast occurred shortly after lawyers gathered at a hospital to protest and mourn the killing of a provincial bar association leader. Terrorism analyst Greg Barton of Australia's Deakin University called it a sophisticated attack.
I think, though, that the most disturbing aspect about this attack is just how common it's become. Pakistan has probably lost more than 50,000 people to terror attacks since 9/11, the 15 years since then, and it's probably had an economic impact of around $100 billion. So the situation is almost out of control. I mean, it's not so out of control that life in Pakistan doesn't go on, but it brings to mind the analogy of a frog being slowly boiled to death as the water temperature in a pan of water slowly increases. The new normal in Pakistan is truly dreadful.
A faction of the extremist Pakistani Taliban, Jamaat-ul-Ahrar, claimed responsibility. The same group claimed responsibility for an Easter Day attack in the second largest Pakistani city, Lahore, in March, that claimed more than 70 lives. Ethiopian opposition members, residents, and a rights group said Monday several dozen people, one account said more than 90, were killed, hundreds wounded, when security forces opened fire on anti-government protesters across Oromia and Amhara regions over the weekend. Authorities who blame what it calls illegal protests on foreign enemies blocked social media access since Friday. Protests earlier this year were sparked by a now-abandoned plan to expand the capital, Addis Ababa, into outlying Oromia farmland. They persisted with the prolonged attention of opposition leaders. This is VOA News. In Syria, government-allied forces and rebels poured in reinforcements to the embattled city Aleppo Monday after a rebel assault captured most of a government military complex and broke a three-week siege of rebel-held districts. Hundreds of pro-regime fighters from Iran, Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon have reportedly been deployed. Tens of thousands of civilians are trapped in the city. The UN Security Council Monday said they must not be cut off from outside aid. Samantha Power is the U.S. UN ambassador.
As we meet, humanitarian access to eastern Aleppo remains cut off by fighting. And it is possible that it will become difficult to get humanitarian aid to tens or even hundreds of thousands more people in western Aleppo.
Meanwhile, the medical charity Doctors Without Borders said at least 13 people were killed in the bombing of a hospital in rebel-held Idlib province. A UN committee expressed concern over the fate of four Burundian lawyers who faced disbarment for giving information about alleged torture in the East African country to the committee. The UN Committee Against Torture urged the government to provide urgent reassurance no one will be punished for taking part in a Geneva meeting last month. The committee expressed concern over allegations of killings and torture of opposition figures by the ruling party's youth wing. The United States Monday expressed concern about extrajudicial killings in the Philippines as the country pursues a war against the illicit drug trade. Elizabeth Trudeau is a U.S. spokesperson.
As you know, and you've heard us say many times from this podium, speaking broadly, is we believe in rule of law. We believe in due process. We believe in respect for universal human rights. We believe fundamentally that those aspects ensure and promote long-term security. We are concerned by these detentions, as well as the extrajudicial killing of individuals suspected to be involved in drug activity in the Philippines.
Since President Rodrigo Duterte came to power in June, hundreds of drug suspects have been killed by police. International carrier Delta is recovering after Monday's computer system failure that delayed or canceled at least half its global flight operations. The problem lasted for about 14 hours. Charlie Leocha is a travel analyst and asked what happened to backup plans.
I find it hard to believe that one outage in one spot in Atlanta can shut down their entire worldwide network. The very first thing we all learn is that if you are going to work with computers, back up your data.
Last month, Southwest Airlines apologized and offered rebates to passengers affected by hundreds of cancellations and thousands of delayed flights when its computer system collapsed. In day three action at the Rio Summer Olympic Games Monday, Rafaela Silva captured Brazil's first gold, winning judo's 57-kilogram division. Australia became the first Olympic champion in women's rugby, beating New Zealand. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm William Eagle in Washington, filling in for James Butte, who's on vacation for 1 week. Today is Tuesday, August 9th, and here are some of the stories we're covering. A potential candidate for Somalia's presidential elections, Mohamed Abdirizak, talks about ways of improving security in the country.
What we need to do is to have a united national force that can defend Somalia and its territory and its people against its enemies, including Al-Shabaab.
Reporter Darren Taylor has an update on South Africa's municipal elections.
The ANC has definitely lost the Nelson Mandela Bay Metropole to the main opposition party, that's the Democratic Alliance, the DA. It's a spiritual heartland for the ANC, so to speak. Analysts are seeing it as a sign that it's perhaps the beginning of the end of the ruling party as we know it.
Also today, a new project in Ghana is using mobile phones to help hold the government accountable to voters. And Cameroonian officials crack down on underage street hawkers. All that and more on Daybreak Africa. In South Africa, the ruling African National Congress lost control of several cities to its rival, the Democratic Alliance. Among those cities won by the DA are the capital Pretoria and the Nelson Bay area, which includes the industrial city of Port Elizabeth. The ANC hung on to the commercial capital Johannesburg, though by a slim margin. Both parties will be considering governing with a coalition of smaller parties. And those areas where they won a plurality of the vote, but not over 50%. I spoke to Johannesburg-based reporter Darren Taylor earlier today for an update on the news.
Where we stand at the moment is that the ANC has definitely lost the Nelson Mandela Bay Metropole to the main opposition party, that's the Democratic Alliance, the DA, and this by almost 7% of the vote there. And this is an area that during apartheid was the center of the ANC struggle against white supremacy. So it's a spiritual heartland for the ANC, so to speak. Analysts are seeing it as a sign that it's perhaps the beginning of the end of the ruling party as we know it. And it's certainly the start of an era of coalition politics in South Africa. The DA will most likely now govern Nelson Mandela Bay in a coalition with a smaller party or two smaller parties, and that will completely freeze the ANC out of this city. The DA has also retained the city of Cape Town with a huge majority, almost 70% to the ANC's 24%. And now moving to Gauteng province, there are three municipalities, including South Africa's biggest and economically most important city, Johannesburg, and the capital city of Pretoria, where just a few percentage points separate the ANC and the DA. In Pretoria, the DA is now the biggest party. It got just over 43% of the vote to the ANC's 41. Now, this isn't enough for the DA to oust the ANC and to govern alone, but it can do so in a coalition over there. In Johannesburg, the ANC has won slightly more votes than the DA. Again, not enough for the ANC to govern alone. So what this now means, and that we are now seeing today over here in South Africa, is that both the ANC and the DA are negotiating with a number of smaller parties who also won votes in the election, but particularly they are trying to court the party that received the third most votes, particularly in Gauteng, and the whole country, in fact, and that is the Economic Freedom Fighters, the EFF.
Do we have any hindsight into why the ANC was being punished by some of their former supporters?
All analysis so far points to urban voters, and particularly black urban voters, turning big time against the ANC. You've got the black middle class in the cities. They used to be a big part of the ANC's traditional support base. They are rebelling against the ANC, basically because they see the party as corrupt. But then you've also got the urban poor, particularly, again, the black urban poor, those who live in shacks in the townships. They're also turning their backs on the ANC because they say the ruling party's councillors are incompetent and are delivering poor basic services to them, such as water, electricity and housing.
Where does President Jacob Zuma stand at this point?
Well, the ANC is pointing to the fact that it still controls most of South Africa's municipalities. So they're sort of papering over the Jacob Zuma question by pointing out facts like this. But at the same time, there are ANC insiders who are saying this drop of more than 8 percentage points from the 2011 polls to a point now where the ANC got less than 54% of the national vote certainly has them panicking, because the ANC is now just 4 percentage points away from losing power completely in South Africa in the next general election in 2019. And when the ANC denies that the poll was a referendum on the performance of Jacob Zuma, the party's really being disingenuous. It clearly was exactly a referendum on Zuma's performance. The big question now that the big question now that analysts and everyone over here is asking is, will the ANC rid itself of Zuma?
That was reporter Darren Taylor speaking with us from Johannesburg, South Africa. Reports in Somalia say the election of national leaders and government institutions is not likely to happen as planned in August and September. The leader of Puntland Regional Administration, Dr. Abdoueli Mohamed Ali, who is one of the key officials making decisions on elections, told VOA that they will be delayed by 2 months. For more on the latest developments about the poll, Mohamed Abdirizak, who wants to compete in the presidential vote, spoke with Peter Cloti about the elections.
The elections that were envisioned in the provisional constitution that were supposed to take in 2016 were supposed to be a one-person, one vote. We knew that wasn't going to take place. What we're talking about now is another sort of selection election that was going to be in place of the real elections. And still, this is what is being delayed. To my knowledge, and according to my sources on the ground, first of all, the presidential elections will take place October 25th. Lower house will be first week of October. And for the first time in Somalia's history, an upper house, another chamber will be created, and that will take place on September 25th.
All right, let me ask you this. Security remains definitely a challenge in Somalia. What's the best way forward to address the insecurity that Al-Shabaab poses to the people of Somalia?
Since I declared my candidacy in May, what I've talked about is the need for a real reconciliation among Somalis, and this is the first step. This is the best way for us to address our security. There have been about 16 conferences in the last 2 decades, all were in the name of reconciliation, but real reconciliation has never really taken place in Somalia, and this is what I call for. And that is the first step. Second is to look at the recruitment and retention, all militaristic, technical ways of improving our armed forces. Currently, we have security forces in Puntland, in Somaliland, in Southwest, in Jubaland, and with the federal government. And these are by no means a national force. What we need to do is to have a united national force that can defend Somalia and its territory and its people against its enemies, including Al-Shabaab.
Well, some say little progress seems to have been made despite donor funds pumped into Somalia. How best do you think the lives of Somalis could be improved with all these goodwill and funds pledged to help the country?
We're grateful to the international community for the funds that they have pledged and the support that they have given to Somalia, not only in terms of financing, but also pushing and being a pressure to the government. But improvement, I think, is a little bit of a stretch, because in the last 4 years, security has worsened. All major hotels in Mogadishu have been attacked. We are up to 18 members of the parliament killed. We have generals killed, we have ministers killed, we have thousands of Somalis, innocent people killed. Students have been killed at graduation ceremonies, women. And so security is, if anything, has backtracked and we're not where we were 4 years ago.
Before we go, briefly, in less than 10 seconds, what do you think your chances are of winning the presidency in Somalia?
I will win the presidency in Somalia.
That was Mohamed Abdirizak, a candidate for Somalia's elections, speaking with reporter Peter Cloti. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm William Eagle in Washington. Today is Tuesday, August 9th. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us in the United States at 202-205-9942. Again, that's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us a message. And here is a shout out to all of our listeners, especially the listeners of our affiliate Brilla FM in Nigeria. And ahead on our program, our listener of the day. A new strategy in Ghana is using mobile phones to broaden citizens' participation in governance, as well as improve accountability of elected officials. The project, which is run by the nonprofit called Pen Plus Bytes Ghana, helps to track promises made by the government to the people and ensures they are carried out. Joanne Demanti has more from Accra.
The initiative is expedited by growth in mobile phone use in Ghana. The National Communication Authority says mobile phone voice penetration increased by more than 100% at the end of March last year, far above the projected rate of 70%. Kwame Ahiabeno is the executive director of Pen Plus Bytes. He says the project encourages civil society organizations and individuals to engage with policy makers and elected officials or duty bearers through text messaging on phones and use of other social media applications. Through this, additional tools aside from face-to-face interactions are made available for the growth of democracy in Ghana. Citizens' participation is, however, necessary to keep the plan on course.
You should have active citizens, citizens who are able to demand for accountability. Without that requirement, it's not going to work. At the other side, you should have duty bearers who are willing to have a listening ear, and more importantly, they are able to action the request from citizens.
A platform is created to aid the sending of text messages to duty bearers. In a recent project involving some members of Ghana's parliament, several queries were sent regarding poor sanitation, uncompleted government projects, and intermittent power supply in varied communities. The messages act as reminders for government officials to live up to promises made to the people. Ahiabenu says the youth are mostly involved in such interactions. However, people who cannot read or write are not left out.
We also rely on radio a lot and the local dialect. So I work with parliament to get the members of parliament to get onto the radio to discuss some of these issues. We also use face-to-face interaction. So we organize what we call town hall meetings, put the issues on the table. By the end of the day, the feedback we collect through these mechanisms are all channeled back to the technology platform.
Community engagements have been held in places such as Ho in the Volta region and Amasaman in the Greater Accra region. Ahiabenu says the project is helping to bring government closer to the people.
It has instilled into people the spirit of participatory democracy. If you are communicating or you are sending consent to somebody, nobody's getting you some form of response, you are not encouraged to participate.
Another advantage is that people are able to hold government officials accountable for their actions. They are also able to follow the progress of ongoing government projects with interest. Joanna Mante for VOA News.
Dozens of children have been temporarily detained in the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé, for street peddling. Authorities there are enforcing a ban on underage hawking, which increases over the summer when schools are closed. The children were only released after their parents promised not to send them out on the streets again. City authorities say the move is intended to protect children against abuse, but it has been, nevertheless, a divisive issue. Eugene Nfongwa reports from the capital, Yaoundé.
It's afternoon rush hour in central Yaoundé. The traffic has come to a halt. Motorists blast their horns impatiently. Young lads jump into the line of cars, shouting into open windows.
Coconut chip. Coconut chip. Coconut.
Scenes like this are common across the city. Children as young as seven, peddling candies, chocolates, and whatever they can fit on tiny trays. Every summer, the numbers go up, swelled by the arrival of thousands of school children on vacation. This year, authorities are cracking down. The mayor of Yaoundé has authorized police to detain underage hawkers until their parents pay a fine. One officer, who did not have clearance to speak to the media, says the instruction is already being implemented.
26 already were arrested at the level of Mokolo. Not arrested as such, you know, you arrest criminals. Were taken to the police station and their parents came and signed engagements never to send them on the streets again.
He says parents who send their children to the streets expose them to abuses, including rape and abductions.
Eight drug addicts had a 15-year-old girl gang raped to the point of almost death this same time last year. She was in an unconscious state at the time the police patrol was passing by. And what was she doing? Selling granules. Yeah. We cannot name the cases of accidents, which are always show. Cases of accidents at these toll gates and all whatnot. Some have been already introduced to drugs. Some are kidnapped for ransom, all of that.
In spite of the crackdown and a radio message by the police, little has changed. At the city's biggest market in Mokolo, underage hawkers are on the lookout for officers and municipal wardens. A police van appears from the end of the street. They dash in every direction. Some trip and fall, others fade into crowded back streets. Jean-Pierre, a 16-year-old selling cheap Chinese flash drive, says the running battles are daily occurrences.
When police encamp here,
he says it's been a cat and mouse race here since the police began arresting them. Some succeed to get away, unlucky ones are arrested, and the parents forced to come to the station. As the running battles continue, public opinion has grown divided. Critics say the crackdown is a war on the poor. Most underage hawkers come from disadvantaged homes in the inner city. The money they make supplement household incomes. Those in support say parents cannot pass the responsibility of providing to children in the name of poverty. This is an argument the police has been citing. They also say authorities have a duty to protect children, whatever their parents' conditions. The police officer we spoke to says authorities have a legal obligation.
We go by the fundamental law of Cameroon. The Constitution protects the child. The International Convention of the Rights of the Child, 1990, protects the child. The African Charter protects the child and other tools and treaties on the protection of the child. There are several others.
Laws like these are unknown to the public and have little meaning. Underage peddling is an old city problem and unlikely to disappear overnight. For VOA Africa, I am Eugene Fongwa in Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Many Americans are familiar with black slavery in the South during the 19th century and its role in igniting the nation's great Civil War. Far less attention has been paid to the black experience in northern cities such as New York, where many escaped slaves and so-called freedmen lived. A new book called Black Gotham sheds some light on that story. VOA's Adam Phillips reports.
Much of the history of black 19th century New York has been lost for several reasons. It was eclipsed in the popular imagination by the saga of Southern slavery. Also, academic historians, most of them white, minimize the contributions of African Americans. No comprehensive archive of black life existed until the 20th century. Still, University of Maryland professor Carla Peterson, the author of Black Gotham, whose own ancestors were distinguished members of the city's black elite, felt theirs was a powerful story that needed to be told.
Writing the book meant a lot to me. It was really a journey of hard work, but also of love and passion.
Led by free blacks, such as clergyman Alexander Crummell, newspaper editor Charles Ray, and businessman George Downing, members of New York's black elite tried to establish themselves as full Americans, not merely as Africans or coloreds, as black slaves had once been called and called themselves. Like members of outsider groups before and since, this African-American elite considered education to be the key to full citizenship.
Beyond that, they were the values of what I would call character and respectability. Character is non-racial. It's what's inside. So it's got no color or no ethnicity, but it is who you are, a good, moral, upright citizen, valuing temperance, a Protestant ethic of hard work, sobriety, and all of those kind of inner values. And respectability then is the outward manifestation of character.
Alliances with whites were often forged. Like white New Yorkers, many in black Gotham wanted to be rich. Peterson notes, though, that results in terms of wealth and social equality were erratic.
So you see black New Yorkers make tremendous gains in terms of entrepreneurship, finding a trade, finding a profession, setting down roots, buying property, feeling that they were at last becoming a genuine part of city life. They would refer to color phobia is fast disappearing in our city. But then there would be a loss.
And violence. The draft riots of July 1863, during the height of the Civil War, were an especially low point in the history of black New York. When President Abraham Lincoln instituted a military draft, many immigrants, especially the Irish, thought they were being asked to fight and perhaps to die in a war being waged for the benefit of blacks, not them. Angry mobs set out to destroy the dwellings and businesses of the city's prosperous African Americans.
And there are vivid accounts of attacks and the utter demolition of their home and their property, and the family climbing over roofs to get to safety or getting in a covered wagon and being taken away.
She points out that more than a century later, many American blacks still lack the educational and economic opportunities that the mainstream enjoys. But she has been gratified to learn that many black groups are inspired by the struggles and incremental successes of 19th century black Gotham. I'm Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Before we leave you, let's take a look one more time at some African news headlines. Reuters Newswire says security forces in Ethiopia shot over 90 people over the weekend in two regions, Oromia and Amhara. In Oromia, weekend protesters took to the streets demanding the release of jailed opposition politicians. Some of them had been involved in protests earlier this year over the planned development of farmland around the regional capital. That's it for the Tuesday, August 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew that includes producer Nicole Beckford and reporter Peter Clote, I'm William Eagle in Washington, wishing you a peaceful Tuesday. Stay tuned for International Edition next on The Voice of America. Of The Voice of America.
Next week on Straight Talk Africa, Shaka Sali and his guests discuss Zambia's general election set for August 11th. The office of the president and seats in the National Assembly are being contested. A constitutional referendum will be held with proposals to amend the nation's Bill of Rights. That's next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com.
The news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.